It's playoff time in the NBA and NHL. Baseball's in full swing, and FanDuel is your place to bet on every game. Right now, brand new customers get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed. $150, win or lose. Bet on everything from slap shots to home runs to slam dunks, and all on an app that's safe, secure, and easy to use. I don't know what you're waiting for. Go to FanDuel.com/Hardy. Make your first bet an automatic win with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in Massachusetts. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Hope is here. Gambling helpline ma.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support. Play it smart from the start. GameSenseMA.com or call 1-800-GAM-1234.
B-Pod Studios.
Gasper and Murray have scorching hot takes. Twisting your mind with Pat Celtics and Bays. They'll also talk socks and out-of-town things. Just call them up on this Saturday. Gasper!
Hey, Murray.
Gasper!
Hey, Murray.
Just call them up on this Saturday. Gasper!
Hey, Murray.
Gasper!
Hey, Murray.
Gasper! From the Town Fair Tire Studio, here at 98.5 of Sports Hub, Gasper and Murray, the two sickest men in radio, maybe the two sickest men in the history of human beings. I feel confident saying that. I know people have died from Ebola and other horrible diseases, Chris, but I think you and I might be the sickest people in history.
Yeah,
but here we are.
I'm gonna try and power through this one, right?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I got all my stuff. I got my cough drops ready to roll. I just popped some cold medicine. So
I think I'm going on.
Let's do it.
9 days of this with the St. Louis flu, because I definitely caught it in St. Louis.
Oh, I did too. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. But see, I don't know. You're saying it's like from the city. Again, I was next to this Canadian media member who was making noises that I've never heard a human being.
Wow.
Of like sneezing and coughing and wheezing and choking. And I mean, the type of sneezing where I was like, what type of bodily fluid is coming out of you right now? So I'm pretty certain that that's where I caught this.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, I definitely caught it in that Enterprise Arena. That place was, there were so many, this is how you know you get old. You're like, oh, I got a chill. But it was so hot there when we were doing the broadcast for Felger and Maz those few days for games 3 and 4. And you go in that arena, it's freezing. I remember one of the days, the Sunday, the game 4, I was like, oh, I got a chill. And the next thing you know, I come home and it's just been hell since. I think we're right to bitch, though. It's been a rough week in Boston sports. What, yes, did it start with David Ortiz getting shot? That story's crazy. We'll get to that. As this thing, the line from Seinfeld, it's like an onion. The more you peel it back, the more it stinks. Kyrie Irving has 1 foot out the door, although a lot of people might look at that as a good thing. But the Celtics do look semi-screwed for the foreseeable future. We'll get to the Sports Up Celtics show coming up at noon. But we will start Bruins. What was just a holy crap to go through all that the last couple of months. I really believe in this team going back as far as, like, I don't know, January. Really, that's, you know, all aboard the Beast Train. Two. Like, I thought that they had something special, and then the East basically falls apart and the path is set for them. They had something special going on. Anyone that, you know, covers the team, that's in the locker room, said this is a special group. They haven't seen this kind of feeling around this team since the run in 2011 when they won the cup. And it felt like all the dominoes were falling their way, right? And they end up with the St. Louis Blues, who were, like, you know, this nice story in the league. And they turn their season around after being, you know, literally the worst team in the league in January. They call up their, what, fourth-string goalie in Jordan Binnington. Here they make the playoffs. But on paper, the Bruins, the more talented team. But if you watched, you paid attention, they basically got pushed around the whole series. So it wasn't that big of a surprise in what happened in Game 7. But it was one hell of a disappointment. You were in the building, as was I. For a time, I left after the second period.
Of course you did.
I make no apologies for that at all. I was the smartest guy in the building. I know a dead body when I see one. The game, Chris, the game was over at 1-0, and it was definitely over at 2-0. See, the man's dying. this is what it's come to today. It's a lot of hacking up. We're coughing up green pudding.
But look, to use it, you know, a Bruins point, like if Noah Chari can play through a broken sternum, then you and I can play Radio Hurt today.
Absolutely.
So, you know, apologies in advance to the listeners out there. You know, it's probably going to sound a little different than you're used to, but we're going to go through it Bruins style. Yeah, I was in the building, and to me, what was surprising about it, Jim, was just the idea of how non-competitive it was. I mean, to your point, you know, you said you know a dead body when you see one. I just felt like the Bruins were never in the game, which was shocking to me for a Game 7 on home ice. And also the idea that I just felt like the Bruins' best was better than the Blues' best, but we only saw it in brief spurts in this series. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the two times you saw it, the Blues were missing somebody from that incredibly effective yet incredibly annoying fourth line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go back to Game 3, Sundqvist is out in that one, and the Bruins' first line gets going, and they're able to get going early, and they sort of blow those guys out. And then you go back to Game 6, Barbashev was suspended in that one. Once again, you see Marchand get on the board on the power play. Pasternak gets exhumed and actually scores a goal and does something in the series. Those were sort of the times when you saw the Bruins at their best. And I think so often in sports, it's about matchups. And I just think that Blues team, the way that they were loaded on the back end and they had four pretty even lines that played 200-foot hockey and heavy hockey, it was just a tough matchup, I think, for the Bruins. Because I am convinced, and I'm taking nothing away from the Blues. I have a lot of respect for them. Really good team, good opponent, worthy champion. But I still think the Bruins are the better team.
Yeah, I do too. I'm dug in on that because I think that they are, if they were to play up to what we all expect them to play up to. And that's why, like, okay, you know, you draw up the blame pie. And at least in terms of this series, and especially on Thursday night, what happened with the top line is inexcusable. The lack of contributions that you got from, you know, the so-called perfection line with Brad Marchand and David Pastrnak and Patrice Bergeron, and I'll even throw David Krejci in there. I mean, it's just inexcusable and unbelievable. If you got even, Chris, you know, people were saying, like, if you got 30 to 50% out of that line, they win this series. Chris, you got 8% out of that top line, they win this series. They essentially got nothing, save for Game 6 when Marchand scores and Pastrnak gets on the board
game
finally.
Game 6, they were good.
And I thought that they were going to finally break through, but they looked tight, lost at times, especially in that second period. And really, it was that second goal where you have the inexcusable line change there from Marchand where he gets lost, and it's 2-0 with, you know, 7 seconds to play in the first. It's like, oh, God, this is over. And I think that they really lost themselves. They played like a team that had played with themselves, for the very first time that night in the second period. It's like, what am I watching here? Their resiliency, their calling card this whole season, poof, it just completely disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, that was the surprising thing. I mean, look, hockey's a strange sport. The bounce of the puck can control fate. Anything can happen in a Game 7. But it wasn't even close. The Bruins were never in the game.
No, they weren't.
Which is so shocking. Again, just given the way the season went for them, the way they had played in the postseason, the way they had played in elimination games, all the things that you had talked about. And I honestly think, like, in listening to these guys afterwards and listening to them yesterday on breakup day and being in the locker room after the game, I think that's the hardest part for these guys to deal with. Like, losing's not easy, and losing a championship obviously is heartbreaking. But they know that they didn't even come close to putting their best foot forward. Like, if you put your best foot forward and you lose and it's a funky bounce or it's a weird bounce off the boards or something fluky happens, or, you know, you get shafted by the referees like they did in Game 5, there's still a lot of angst there. But at least you can sort of talk about it and sort of make it go away because you say, you know what, we were right there. Like, it wasn't our fault. This one, you didn't show up. I mean, you didn't show up at all. And in not only the biggest game of the season, but really the biggest game you've played in 6 years, and you didn't show up and you didn't put your best foot forward. You didn't even give yourself a chance to win a second cup. And one other thing I'll say quickly too is, like, you know, I have so much respect for this Bruins core, starting with Bergeron, who I think is probably one of the most underrated players in Boston sports history. And it saddens me that I now feel like that group led by Bergeron, they're going to go down as a one cup team, a one title team. You know, this was a real opportunity to burnish their legacy, to win a second cup. Because, yeah, they'll always be respected here, and we know that. But in the history of hockey and, you know, outside of the Boston area, I think they really could have made their mark if they won a second cup. And it was right there for them, the way the board broke, having Game 7 in your building, and to show up with that, that's tough to live with.
And that's why I think it's such a disappointment for you nailed it. And that's one of the things that hurts me because, well, one, like, you know, certain teams you love more than others. Like, I loved this team. I think a lot of people did because you could see, like, how collective, you know, they were as a group and how well they played with each other. And the the resiliency, again, the calling card, like how much they dealt with this year in terms of injuries early to Bergeron and Chara and keeping their head above water. Like they just, I loved this team. I know I'm not alone in feeling that way. I felt the same way about the 2014 Patriots. There's certain teams you just connect with a little bit more. And I think that they are considering their talent, like, you know, what Bergeron, I think, has meant to this city, what Chara has meant to this city. They deserve to have another title to solidify what their legacy is. And I think hit to the legacy might be too harsh of a term, but it's disappointing. You know,
it's a lost opportunity.
It is. It is. I'll look at this because I feel like, look, who knows? They could end up going back next year. I don't really feel all that great about it. You know, certain guys that got beat up this year, like Bergeron and Char, another year older, but who knows? But right now, I don't think so, that they're going to get another opportunity like they had this year. And, you know, it just sucks to look at a team as talented and certain players as talented and have to say, you left one on the table. You should have had more. It's like the Brett Favre thing. Hell, it seems to be trending that way for Aaron Rodgers, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's apples to oranges, different sports. But there's certain guys you can look at and you can always feel like, man, you should have had another one. And that's what I think the legacy is going to be for certain players on this team, like your Chara's, Bergeron's, Krejci, Marchand even.
Yeah, know? I mean, I would agree with you. I mean, that's sort of what was on the table for these guys. And you know, again, for me, I don't want to overplay it, and I don't want to exaggerate it. Now, they didn't play their best, and that's on them. But I feel like they did get put in a tough situation based on what happened in Game 5.
Okay, because, yeah, you and I haven't worked with each other in a couple of weeks, and that was obviously the big talking point a week ago today going into Game 6. We'll get to that. And the other thing in terms of legacy, one name hasn't been brought up, and that's Tuukka Rask, who you had a column on in the fallout after the loss in Game 7. I know I quickly turned on him. Shocker. Doesn't take much for me.
Yeah, of course it doesn't.
That's a guy who I also think takes a massive, massive hit, despite the fact that they wouldn't have been there without him. That's factual. We all know that. If you watch this run, they do not get to Game 7 in the Stanley Cup Final without the play of Tuukka Rask. But I'll say it again, like I said on Phil Grimes, were any of you really that surprised? Deep down in your core, were you that surprised? Were you that surprised when he let up that first one? Even the second one, he should have had one of them. Two shots, four goals, that also is inexcusable. We'll get to that as well as some of the fallout from yesterday where it was, what do they call that? It's a walk-away day.
Yeah, breakup day.
Breakup day. Boy, you hear what a mash unit that this team really was. And I also want to know if you think of it as excuses, because last night Adam Jones, boy, he went in. He called it excuse day. He was getting all over these guys.
Of course he did.
You know, he's the Dark Knight. This is what he does. But we'll get to all of that. The legacy on Rask, the fallout of all the injuries that we hear about for some of these players from yesterday, and I want to know your thoughts on Game 5 and how much Kelly Sutherland and the refs might have affected this series, Chris. We'll get to all that coming up here on a very sick Gasper and Murray on 98.5 The Sports Hub.
Stay tuned for more Gasper and Murray on 98.5 The Sports Hub.
Yeah, I've got multiple fractures, and it's been reinforced with two plates, you know, some wires and screws.
Yeah, like through playoffs, dealing with some groin issues and an abdomen issue, but nothing that was too bad. Yeah, I just sprained it. I sprained it early on, and then it did it again in that exhibition, you know, the game there, the inter-squad game, but it wasn't bad or anything like that, so it was all right.
I think everyone saw what happened in Game 2 against Toronto, and then from then on I was kind of battling some things here and there, but nothing that I didn't think that I could, you know, play through. There's, you know, it's this time of year, it's just a matter of will. And
yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it seems like we're all in that same situation, I guess, and you're trying to battle and make the most of it, and you know, I'll never use that as an excuse, and you know, every year comes with different challenges, and this time around was that, but it happened later in the playoffs too, so it wasn't the whole time, and it is what it is. You know, you have to try to make the most of it.
That was an assortment of beat up Bruins at breakup day yesterday. I mean, some of the stuff you hear from some of these guys and what they were dealing with. Zdeno Chara with the wires and screws and plates in his jaw, which we knew that he broke in, what was that, Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Final against St. Louis Blues. It's Gasper Murray, 98.5 of Sports. I hear Patrice Bergeron in there, that he was dealing with a abdominal an ab and groin injury. Jesus, all this cold medicine just turning me even dumber. It sounds like so many of these guys. Who was it? It was Nola Chari that was dealing with a broken sternum.
I mean, that's a car crash injury.
And that's exactly, yeah, I'm glad you said that. That's what a lot of these things sound like. Like the after effects of a massive car accident. It's unbelievable. The stuff that these guys put them through. So, you know, Adam Jones, Knights here on 98.5 of Sports, using the label excuse day, kind of mocking some of these injuries and saying that it gets them off the hook. Do you look at it that way? I mean, they're asked the questions.
No.
This happens every year, win or lose. You find out from the Blues, Ryan O'Reilly, who ended up getting the Conn Smythe Trophy, and rightfully so, he was phenomenal in this series, was playing with a broken rib. I mean, all this stuff comes out. I don't really look at it as excuses. We were going to find this stuff out regardless.
Yeah, I don't look at it as excuses. I mean, this is sort of the ritual in hockey. You know, you reveal the injuries afterwards, and it's not so much about saying this is why we lost. I mean, for the reporters who are asking, it's like, okay, who might need a surgery, who's going to need medical attention at the end of the season? And I didn't hear any Bruins using it as an excuse. In fact, I heard the exact opposite, like Brad Marchand saying, well, it wasn't that bad. So I haven't heard any of the Bruins use it as an excuse. Now
Patrice Bergeron literally said there's no excuse.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, I haven't heard any Bruins fans use it as an excuse either. And I think if they did, that would be a mistake, given what you just said about Ryan O'Reilly, you know, winning the Conn Smythe and scoring 9 points in the series and being the first guy since Gretzky to score in, you know, 4 straight games and all that. He's doing that with a cracked rib. So you can't sort of turn around and say, okay, well, this is why we lost. I think it's legitimate for them to reveal the injuries, but it's obviously not an excuse for the performance because the Blues were banged up too.
Give me your perspective on Tuukka Rask. Does it change? I know you wrote the column, but for those who didn't see it, I think it is fair to say, without any question, they are not there in Game 7 against the Blues in the Stanley Cup Final without the play of Tuukka Rask, because I think that he was excellent the first three rounds. But does the legacy go back to questioning him after his play in Game 7?
You know, I think for him, the legacy doesn't change, and that's the problem. You know, I think the only way that he can change it is to backstop them to a cup, and he's come really close twice now, and there's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, after the game, Krejci said, you know, he's the MVP. He's the MVP of our team. We're not here without him. And that's so true. And I thought they hung him out to dry, to be honest, in Game 7. But that position, Jim, to me, is like quarterback in the NFL. The reality is that the nuance of what happened in Game 7 and Marchand and that, you know, Matador line change and all that will all fade, and it becomes a bottom line thing. And when Felger's having this discussion about Tuukka Rask, not even 2 weeks from now, but 2 years from now, if he doesn't have a cup, it's going to be you lost, you know, the two times you made it to the Stanley Cup final. And both those times, a lot of pucks went in the net in a short period of time. It's not fair. I think Tuukka deserves better. I thought he deserved better from his teammates, he deserved better from fate. But that's the way sports goes, and we know, particularly at that position, it's a what have you done for me lately, binary, bottom line thing. Did you win or did you lose? Have you won the big one or have you not? And he hasn't. It's not all his fault, but that's the fact.
Yeah, it is a quarterback thing. It is a team game. And again, I think most of the blame should go on the first line, specifically guys like Brad Marchand, who, again, you know, lets up and is trying to get off the ice and allows, is part of why the reason that second goal is allowed. But also, I think both things can be true. Tuukka Rask was not that great in that game. He should have had one of those first two. The second was a complete backbreaker, and he wasn't that good in the game. He just wasn't. He wasn't. He was awesome in the first three rounds. He was. He was meh, I thought, in the final. I thought that
really?
I thought
he was pretty good in Game 6.
He was excellent in Game 6. He's half the reason they got to Game 7. But in other games, I thought he was
He was, to me, look,
was
I know.
Game 3, that wraparound that he gave to Ryan O'Reilly, like, that can't happen. Yeah. Wraparounds in the NHL, I'm sorry, unless you're a bum goalie, like, those can't happen.
I thought, on the whole, in the series, and I know Binnington was good in Game 7, particularly early. I thought the stops he made on Marcus Johansson and David Krejci on sort of a really nice backdoor pass from Krug in the first period on the power play, I thought those were huge stops. But to me, he was shaky all series long, Binnington. You know, and I thought Tuukka Rask was clearly the better goalie in the series. And you know, going to Game 7, that Binnington in the series had a goals against over 3
mm-hmm.
going into Game 7. So it's just sort of funny how perception gets shaped.
But his bounce-back games were real good throughout
they
the postseason. They really
they
were. And in this series.
But I feel like every goal the Bruins scored, like, went off his glove.
Yeah.
Or, like, maybe it's just his body language, because he always sort of has the the countenance of shame every time the puck goes in the net. Like, he should have had it.
Yeah.
And then you look at it, a lot of times you feel like, geez, he should have had it. I'm talking about Binnington. And so maybe I'm buying too much into that. But he was really good in Game 7. But I also think, again, you know, with the whole goalie thing, goalies, I always say this, goalies are like quarterbacks in the NFL and presidents in the economy. They get too much of the credit when things are going well and too much of the blame when things go poorly. And Binnington was good, but the Blues defensively basically kept the Bruins to the periphery of the ice. Like, everything was from the outside. The Bruins either were unwilling or unable to get into any of the dirty areas to really challenge Binnington. Everything was from the perimeter, from the outside.
Oh, yeah, no, they, in front of him, they were great. Their defense is, you know, the calling card of that team, and they wore teams down. If you paid attention, yeah, especially, you know, look, I think people started paying attention to the Western Conference Finals because of the Bruins sweep. They wore San Jose down.
Yep.
And some of that was with some headshots and cheapness. They ended up knocking out, was Hurdle, Tomas Hurdle, and who was the other? Pavelski in Game 5. They don't travel for Game 6. There were really no calls. So let's dial it back to Game 5. You and I have seen each other for the first time in a couple of weeks doing this show. Dubious calls. Kelly Sutherland does not put the hand in the air. No whistle for the blatant trip of Nola Chari. Leads to the second goal. And that, you know, for all intents and purposes, sealed the game. Bruins ended up putting one on the board. But I think both things can be true. The Bruins didn't have a very good game. They got pushed around. But the officiating did affect that game. How much did the officiating affect that game in particular and the series as a whole? Because a lot of people have been bitching about it.
I thought it was huge. And look, maybe I'm guilty of hyperbole. Certainly that's what the emailers who have contacted me from Missouri have said. But I think that was huge. That was a tipping point in the series. And the thing about it was that the way Binnington had played in the series and was playing in that game, you knew he was going to give one up, and he did.
Yeah.
So 1-0 was nothing. Like, you knew they were going to get to the guy because he was so shaky. But making it 2-0, it gave the Blues a pad and a margin for error that they shouldn't have had. And it led basically directly to the goal. I mean, to me, I still feel like that non-call is just unconscionable when you go back and look at it. I mean, the way Tyler Bozak basically forklifted Achari off the puck and off his skates.
And he immediately turned to someone to say, like, to
"Bah, what, you didn't see nothing."
He's
the act of a guilty man always in sports.
All right. So let's hear from you on this. Any fallout you got left over from Wednesday night's Game 7 loss? I said it was Thursday night. See, I'm all confused. I'm all hopped up on Sudafed here for going on near 2 weeks. See, this is all I got out of this.
And also, Chara was hurt in Game 4. You said Game 3.
Yeah. See, I'm a mess. 2 months, all I got out of this Bruins playoff run here, Chris, was I'm fatter, dumber, and now sick. After that, I did nothing but eat and probably drink too much, like many of you watching these playoff games, and we got nothing. We should be having a parade on this beautiful Saturday, and we got nothing.
Instead, it's in St. Louis, and it starts in about an hour.
Ugh. Let's start with, I think I'm a little bit locked up here. Joe in Bedford. Go ahead, Joe.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Good. A true hardcore Bruin fan is not surprised with what happened with Tuca. That's the first thing. And second of all, they went to St. Louis for Game 6, and they punched them in the mouth. They came out with a 5-1 win. You know, I'm saying, okay, so they went there, they punched them in the mouth, and then they come back. I just like to know what happened. How did St. Louis figure out Game 7 and the Bruins didn't after what they did in St. Louis on Game 6?
I'll tell you this. Having been in St. Louis for that game and feeling what was going on in the city and the sort of sense of civic excitement and pride, it was a major letdown when the Blues lost. And they lost a game that they really weren't competitive in. And so I wonder if psychologically the Bruins sort of felt like, because I felt this whole series, the Bruins were trying to throw knockout punches, you know, sort of like, even like go back to Game 1, you know, they had that tremendous second period after they didn't really play well in the first. I felt like they felt they could play really, really well in spurts, and that would be enough to deter the Blues. And I wonder if psychologically they felt like we broke them. You know, the whole city wanted them to win. They thought they were going to win this on their home ice. There's ads in the, you know, e-version of the paper and all this stuff. And we went down there and dominated in their building, and now they have to come back to our building. We have them right where we want them. They're broken. And I wonder if there was a little bit of a letdown thing. And the Bruins did come out and play well in that first period.
Yeah.
But that sort of goes to my point. They, like, came out, we're going to throw a couple of haymakers, and these guys will fold. And it's like, oh, wait, no.
Yeah. Oh, no. Again, the resiliency that I talked about with the Bruins, that was also real with the Blues. And, in fact, they ultimately had a little bit more, I think, than Boston did. 617-779-0985. You want to join the show, get some open phone lines. There are other things we have to get to throughout the week, including the David Ortiz shooting. We'll get to that. And this Nick Caserio nonsense that went on this week with the New England Patriots.
That was a news dump last night.
It really was.
A story here.
Yeah, so we're going to get to that coming up because I know, Chris, you got some thoughts. We'll do that right after the Sports Hub headlines here with Mike Sarge-Riley on a very sick Gasper Murray here on 98.5 of Sports Hub.
This is Gasper and Murray.
You will listen.
98.5, the Sports Hub.
Well, what's going on is the Patriots are a little curious about the timing of the Houston Texans firing Brian Gain last Friday and then beginning their search, targeting Nick Caserio to be their new general manager. Just consider this, Andrew. The Patriots had their ring ceremony to celebrate their latest Super Bowl win. That was on Thursday. Jack Easterby, the pastor who has gained significant influence in the Texans organization, who is basically running this search for a general manager, he was there, as was Nick Caserio. Then the request goes in after they fire Brian Gain. The next day, the request goes in for Caserio and a couple others that they ended up interviewing. The Patriots are at least curious about the time there. They've asked the league to investigate this. Here's a couple things we need to know, though. First of all, the Texans are digging in. They're not giving in. They're digging in. They're not abandoning their pursuit of Caserio. They still want him, so expect this to be ongoing. Two, there is a way to solve this potentially with draft pick compensation, because it's hard to imagine Andrew Caserio going back to New England after they filed tampering charges for a team trying to hire him. This may end up coming to kind of fruition with draft picks going either way and the Texans getting a new GM.
All right, so that was earlier in the week, NFL.com's Ian Rappaport. What was going on between the Houston Texans and their desperate lust, it felt like, for Patriots player director of player personnel Nick Caserio. And then we get this news dump late yesterday, Chris, where everything's all good and it's dropped. You get the little press release put out by the Houston Texans CEO. It was a McNair, shocker. So saying like, hey, it's all good, we've dropped this. And then the Patriots also said that they're not going to file any tampering charges. And it's like, okay, wipe the slate clean. We're all good here between these two teams. I don't know. This whole thing is weird. What do you make of all this? And especially because, you know, when there's a Friday news dump, there always feels like there's something a little bit more behind the scenes. What's your take on all
so,
this?
So I have a big picture take on this. I think that Bill Belichick has Jimmy Garoppolo'd Caserio. You know, the same way Brady has sort of outlasted Garoppolo and forced the move where he had to go because he wasn't ready to step away. I think the idea for the Patriots was Caserio was going to take over pretty soon. And now it's like, who knows when Bill is stepping down. And maybe Caserio's looking around at this point. There's been a lot of movement in the Patriots organization this offseason. You know, it probably went unnoticed, but they lost their national scout, DeJuan Daniels. He left for the Oakland Raiders. There's sort of a scenario right now in the organization where it's really difficult, I think, for guys to move up. Even the coaches who went with Brian Flores to Miami, like a guy like Chad O'Shea or Jerry Schaplinski, who was the assistant quarterbacks coach, it's like Josh McDaniels coming back, those guys are totally blocked. And I feel like a lot of these guys now are totally blocked. And that's sort of part of the issue here. And it's pretty clear that this is something Caserio was interested in and ready to move on from the Patriots and take this job and work with Bill O'Brien and sort of run his own shop. And I don't know if you have the Texans statement up there, but they talked about what the job was.
Yeah, so Texans CEO Cal McNair said in a statement, "We have now been made aware of certain terms in Nick's contract with the Patriots. Once we are made aware of these contract terms, I advise Mr. Kraft we would be stopped pursuing Nick. We started the process to interview Nick Caserio for our EVP GM position.
Executive Vice President. So, I mean, right now, Caserio is Director of Player Personnel. He doesn't even have the title that Scott Pioli had. When Scott Pioli was here at the end, he was Vice President of Player Personnel. Nobody has gotten that title since he left. And Casario's been here for a while, and he has not gotten that title. So the Texans are saying you're Executive Vice President / General Manager.
Which is a hell of a bump.
It is. Now, what's really interesting here is Tom Pelissero of NFL Network had some interesting reporting last night, and I think this maybe eluded a lot of people. I'm just going to read two tweets from Tom, if you'll indulge me.
Sure, yeah.
So one is, my understanding is the call between Cal McNair and Robert Kraft was very cordial. Language at issue in Nick Caserio's contract had been there for a while. Once Texans were aware, they asked what a trade would cost. No deal, so they move on and drop tampering charge. So the Texans are made aware of this clause in the contract of Caserio, which, oh, by the way, I would love to know if Caserio and his agent interpret it the way the Patriots do, which is essentially you can't interview for any other jobs. That seems kind of odd. But even being confronted with this, the Texans were ready to make a deal, but it seems like the teams could not come to a deal. Here's more from Pelissero on Caserio's contract. Nick Caserio's contract with the Patriots is up after the 2020 draft, per sources. So after dropping pursuit of Caserio in light of contract issue, the Texans' options now are one, hire someone else as GM, or two, wait until next year. For now, I'm told the process will continue.
Well, it feels like that's what they're going to do, is wait, because from all reports, is Houston's not going to hire anybody.
O'Brien and Easterby can do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So they'll wait for him to be available next year.
But that
year.
Means Caserio essentially is a hostage in Fort Foxborough.
Well, that's what it feels like.
Doesn't want to be here.
Yeah. No, it's like when they go into to Homer Simpson's office and Mr. Burns puts up the demotivational plaque that says, "You're here forever." Like, that's what's essentially happened to Nick Caserio in this situation. Why would you even want to show up to work when you want to go? You had a better opportunity to have a better bump and probably more pay, too. At least, you know, the title's better than what you have right now. And you're stuck here? Like, that's going to suck.
I mean, it's really interesting to me, and I'm wondering sort of who's driving it. I think Bedard's had some information that you referenced yesterday. Is it being driven more by Belichick, who's basically saying, I need this guy, he's under contract, I don't like some of my former proteges poaching, so I'm going to prove a point? Or is it being driven more by the Crafts, who are saying, we don't want Caserio to go, we want to keep him here, he's maybe part of some sort of succession plan, or they're offended by sort of Jack Easterby's actions and sort of some of the things that have come out, the conjecture in the wake of what happened with Robert Kraft down in Florida. Like, I'm curious who's driving this, because either way, I think Caserio's collateral damage, but either way, I think it's sort of a bad precedent for the Patriots to hold an employee against their will away from an opportunity for advancement.
So there's this from John McClain of the Houston Chronicle, because, you know, there was the allusions there from Tom Pelissero, what's going on with Caserio's contract.
Yep.
McClain of the Houston Chronicle reports that Caserio has a clause in his contract that says he can't interview with other teams. Oh, God, you should have read that, or your agent should have read that before, Nick. Jesus. And so he goes on to write what Cal McNair had in the statement. So that's all. Has a clause in a contract that he can't interview with other teams.
That basically means you can't take any other job, though.
He should have never signed that.
I mean, I that's kind of weird. And again, I would be curious, like, is that the interpretation Caserio and his agent had at the time? Like, is it a right to match type of thing? Or is it just, like, literally there's a clause in there that says you can't interview for any other jobs? And then even moving forward, like, I don't think this is done. Because if you're the Patriots and you know now Caserio wanted this job, are you going to just keep him here sort of against his will? And, like, I mean, the guy is an incredibly hard worker, so you'll get whatever he's got. I mean, that's just the way he's wired. But do you want to do that knowing it's a short-term thing? Or do you go back to the Texans and say, let's talk about this, we can work out a deal? And I'll tell you this, the Texans are due to pick up a compensatory third-round pick in next year's draft, because they lost Tyrann Mathieu to the Chiefs. All those projections say that. So if they're willing to give up a 3, which they might not be, or even a 4 for Caserio, if I'm the Patriots, at this point, like, I'm going to do that, because there are other guys in the organization. They're not as good, I think, as Nick, but whether it's Monty Osenfort, Brian Smith, Dave Ziegler, like, those guys, they can pick up the rope. And it seems like Nick's maybe a short-timer anyway here, because he's been Garoppolo'd by Bill, who's going to coach, like, forever.
That's a good way to put it. Well, Bill and the rest of the Patriots brass, don't be surprised when you find onions in the ceiling. And, you know, you have Nick Caserio, you know, not trying, or, you know, taking longer lunches. This is all things I did when I saw the sinking ship and the writing on the wall at WFNX that I was about to be fired. I would put, like, lunch meat and onions in the drop ceiling. And I would take, like, 2-hour lunches and just, like, smoke a bunch of weed and then just watch all the MILFs that would walk in and out of the Swampscott Whole Foods. I was a very bad employee. So don't be surprised, Bill, when that starts happening down in Foxborough.
Can I just add one more thing on this? The other thing I'm intrigued about, and I want, you know, I need to dig into this, obviously, but, you know, Patriots beat guys, I'm curious to see what happens with this, because Caserio's, not only has he been there forever, but there were, like, real ties. Like, he met his wife at the Patriots. So at this point in his career, for him to be willing to consider another job and move on, I find it to be really intriguing. Like, what's driving that?
It's been such a mass exodus, like you said, this whole offseason. Like, what the hell's going on behind the
scenes? Exactly. That's my question. Like, does everybody just feel, like, blocked? Like, this is never going to change because Bill's the coach and Josh is the offensive coordinator with this, you know, crazy deal he got, and nobody's going to ever be able to move up. I mean, I think that was part of Daniels moving on. But the whole dynamic in the organization right now, I think, is really fascinating.
People trying to flee like it's East Germany, and Bill's just sitting there crossed arms like, nope,
you're here forever.
All right, long commercial-free segment coming up next. We will segue into the Sports Hub Celtics show, but we have to touch on the David Ortiz shooting. Again, bad week in Boston sports. And your call, see you hanging. Some of you still want to talk about the fallout of Game 7, the Bruins lose, and Stanley Cup Final, the St. Louis Blues. All that coming up next here, Gaspar Murray, 98.5, the Sports Hub.
Another strange twist in the investigation into the shooting of David Ortiz. The alleged trigger man, Rafi Ferreira Cruz, yells to reporters Ortiz was not his intended target, that he was confused by Ortiz's clothes.
It was confusing. I was told the color of the clothing, nothing else. I didn't see him.
A prosecutor in the Dominican Republic disputes that, saying the gunman is clearly seen on surveillance footage going right up to Ortiz and shooting without hesitation. The prosecutor says the suspect already admitted under interrogation to being part of a conspiracy to kill Ortiz, and that they believe he's making up a story to avoid being killed in jail for allegedly targeting such a beloved figure. A total of 9 suspects have been taken into custody, and prosecutors tell CNN some have been cooperating.
That tells me that there's a potential organization here. It is not just a case of mistaken identity. It's probably an organization, and there's some reason for why Mr. Ortiz was targeted.
All right. With each passing day, this story gets more salacious. The shooting of David Ortiz, and obviously, we wish him the best, and thankfully he's still alive. This was so nuts. You know, you're trying to watch Game 6, getting ready for this, and you hear David Ortiz shot in the Dominican Republic. Huh? What? And it's initially reported as a robbery, shot in the leg. No, it was a straight-up assassination attempt. We've now seen the video. There's even a clearer video that's been posted on TMZ. And by the way, just as an aside, like people, I don't want to watch that. I'm not watching that. If you're a reporter, watch it. Do your effing jobs. Anyway, you see this thing. And to me, I was convinced even watching the real grainy one initially, I thought, having grown up around guns, my dad's a bit of a responsible gun nut. I was like, that gun jammed. Guy gets off 2 shots. You can see it in the clear video. It's bang, bang. And then there's and the guy takes off. Like that gun jammed. So maybe that's, half the reason that David Ortiz is thankfully still alive. But this is a hit. I don't buy what you just heard there in that CNN report as we're coming back, that the guy, who one of the people that they've locked up for this, say, we targeted the wrong guy. No, you didn't. No, they showed us the clothes, the flashy Versace shirt that David Ortiz was the only person wearing. He's pretty noticeable. He's the most noticeable person in the Dominican Republic, the most famous and beloved person in the Dominican Republic. That's who you were going for. Some of these reports, and again, these are just reports and assumptions, that David Ortiz might have been fooling around with the girlfriend of a big drug dealer down there, pisses him off. Obviously, life is cheap, unfortunately, in certain areas of the world. This guy, some of the reports early saying that this drug dealer hired guys that worked for the Dominican police to pull this off. And I tend to think, now that these guys are trying to say, like, no, we have the wrong guy, here's my guess, that these policemen that might have been hired then farmed this out and outsourced it to, some street thugs or whatever. They screwed up the job, and now they're trying to cover their own ass. What's your take on all of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one to sort of wade through. I mean, first and foremost, you're happy that Ortiz is still alive and he's getting the medical care that he needs. I'm suspicious of how many people they're rounding up. It just sort of feels like...
Are we in double digits? I believe we are. It's at least 9 as of right now.
I feel like if there's this many people involved, and maybe it was the gun jamming, to your point, but if it's... Let me back it up a little bit. So if it's this drug dealer and he's trying to do... I mean, this guy has had many people killed. Why would he need to, have like 12 people involved with killing David Ortiz?
To try to remove himself as far away as possible? Because, like, I think... I don't know.
Do you think the guy cares about that? Like, I mean, he's
there could be repercussions. Look, I mean, just in terms of numbers, I mean, the whole David Ortiz is so beloved in that country. Like, there could be a real uprising from the community. I guess for lack of a better term, to go after this drug dealer and, like, you know, we go after him. You know, if he finishes the job and then a couple of people that get pinched for it, they're looked at as the guys that did it and that's it, and they keep their mouths shut and their families are taken care of by this drug dealer going forward, then the drug dealer really never is implicated.
But here's the thing. It's like anything. The smaller you keep the circle, the less likely it is that the details will leak out. You make the circle bigger, the more likely it is that you can be implicated and that there can be some sort of issue. So, I mean, this isn't this guy's first rodeo with this, so it seems odd to me. So my point is, this doesn't kind of add up to me. Like, they're rounding up so many people that I feel like they're covering something up. And it could be, to your point, what those early sort of reports and the rumors, conjecture was about some sort of law enforcement involvement in the hit. Because that would make a lot of sense to me. It's like, we're going to distract you by just throwing all these guys into jail, and like all these guys were involved in this huge conspiracy, and you'll never be able to dig through it and find out that some of our guys were involved in this conspiracy.
It's terrible. And again, thankfully he's alive. And I have to say, boy, the other thing I feel for David Ortiz is when he is ready and, you know, getting out of that hospital, I feel for that man, for that conversation he's going to have with his wife, Tiffany, because I'm sure she's got a lot of questions. He did it to himself, allegedly, but boy, I feel for him for that con. That's going to be a long, long, painful conversation. Can I just stay in the hospital here? They're really taking... Nope. Now it's time to go home, David, and we're going to have a talk. Oh, geez.
That might be one where he's, you know, obviously we hope he's recuperating. It's very serious. You know, we don't mean to make light of it, but that might be one where he's like, oh, I think I need another surgery. Yeah. I'll be right back.
She walks into the room, and he's just going, beep, beep. David, I know you're alive. We need to talk. Beep, beep. No, honey, huh? Beep. I'm dead. Walk. Go. Go. Oh, that's going to be bad. But, hey. All the best to him. And I just think that this thing's going to get more nuts the more it unfolds. I just think that that's
a given.
The whole
thing's nuts.
Crazy.
I mean, that someone, you know, look, the whole idea that someone would want to kill David Ortiz, particularly in the Dominican where he's a national hero, it just doesn't make any sense to me. It's one of the more shocking stories. And it just sort of speaks overall to, you know, the society we live in. And I don't mean the Dominican, but just in general, the degree of haterade that's out there and jealousy and just people sort of feeling like, you know, if they want something, they can take it or they can claim it. I mean, it's really sickening, to be honest with you, that someone would try and do this to David.
I know. It is. It's kind of a microcosm of the world we live in now, how life is cheap and you did me wrong, you got to die.
Like, you got to die. I mean,
okay, so like, you know, if David Ortiz did this and he was, you know, stupping somebody else's wife or whatever, a girlfriend, at worst, you catch a beating and you shouldn't have done that. And you obviously have to deal with the repercussions in your personal life and with those that you hurt. But from the person that whose girlfriend you were doing or, you know, or whatever, like, you catch a beating at worst to get shot over it, an assassination attempt.
Yeah,
like that's
assassinate
insane.
The guy.
Absolutely insane. Quickly want to squeeze in Greg in Portland, Oregon, who's listening on the Sports Hub app.
Hi, guys. Hi. Hey, Jim, I just wanted to, you really touched on everything about the Bruins, the loss and everything earlier, and I just wanted to weigh in that, you know, I don't need to bring up anything because you took the words out of my mouth, unfortunately. Very sad. But, Jim, I've really enjoyed you the last few years, and I still remember your iconic radio show in Atlanta from 2013.
Geez.
God, I will never forget that. That made me a fan of you. So... and the last thing is, a couple weeks ago, or seems like it, your observations about St. Louis, I'm there with you, brother.
thanks, Greg, and I really appreciate the comments
as
well.
You're a big fan there. By the way, as you left the garden, is there any truth to the rumor that you said, Tuca, take that, you bum?
No, I didn't. Okay. I was mostly just like in a silent steam from the second period on.
That Steelers game I watched with you that time?
Boy, yeah.
That was an uncomfortable social experience.
Oh, yeah, no. And then, there was a point, too, in that second period where I'm just, like, MFing the ice and realize, like, I'm watching this in the Sports Hub box where there's literally, like, powerful people, not just my immediate boss, but, like, the boss of bosses and Ryan, our great sales manager here, like, and I'm just saying the worst things. I was like, that's my real, I'm like, you got to get out of here. Like, you should be locked up. You should not watch these games in public. I've known that forever. But, you know, it's game 7, first time ever, home ice in the garden. Like, I had to be there, but I should not have been there. And that's, seeing I'm sick, too. That's why I ran out of there at the end of the second period. Hey, before we get to the Sports Up Celtics show, Ninth annual Who's Your Caddy Classic, happening Monday, July 15th, 2 p.m. Atkinson Resort and Country Club, just across the border in Atkinson, New Hampshire. Oh, my God, I can't talk. Starting this Monday morning at 9 a.m., reserve your spot at 98.5sportsup.com. This thing usually sells out in minutes. I've done this with the station the last, well, since I've been back here, what, 4 years now. So get on this. If you want to play, Maz plays, I play. I'm a hack. I'm terrible. If you just want to show up and see what a bad golfer I am, you want to get in on this. It's $150 per player. All to benefit the Pediatric Advanced Care Team at Boston's Children's Hospital. Join Maz, Tucker and Rich, Hardy, myself, the rest of the Sports Hub crew for a day of golf at the Who's Your Caddy Classic, 98.5sportshub.com for details. Sarge, I imagine you'll be there. You're a golfer, right?
You know, I played in it 2 years ago. Yeah. Not sure if I'll be doing it this year or not. We'll see. TBA.
A very busy Sarge.
That's right, buddy.
You can squeeze us into your schedule.
It's a great course, though.
Oh, it is. And, that is an awesome, awesome course up there at Atkinson. Yep. Okay, Sarge is going to get you caught up. Sports Hub headlines. We're a little behind here. We've got to get to the Sports Hub Celtics show. Anthony Davis, you still want him? We'll get to this here on the Sports Hub.
Ah, take that, Reimer, you bum.
It's playoff time in the NBA and NHL. Baseball's in full swing. And FanDuel is your place to bet on every game. Right now, brand new customers get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed. $150, win or lose. Bet on everything from slap shots to home runs to slam dunks, and all on an app that's safe, secure, and easy to use. I don't know what you're waiting for. Go to FanDuel.com/Hardy. Make your first bet an automatic win with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in Massachusetts. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Hope is here. Gambling helpline MA.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support. Play it smart from the start. GameSenseMA.com or call 1-800-GAM-1234.
Be honest, wouldn't you like to play more golf this year? As the State Golf Association for Massachusetts, Mass Golf is ready to help, and they want you to become a member. By joining, you'll automatically get a handicap index from the USGA, access to play exclusive private clubs through Mass Golf events, and a bundle of additional benefits. Best of all, it costs just $55 to join. Visit massgolf.org and make today a golf day.